James Murdoch implicated in News of the World, that whole story. James, yes, and Lachlan, now the sons of Murdoch, who are running Fox.
Right. James was running the European, he was overseeing the British newspapers at that point. I mean, he was had a sort of bigger job than that, but he was right in the center of that scandal. They dealt with that scandal very differently. They kept having internal investigations that would clear everyone except for a few bad apple employees, and then they would move on, and then there would be new headlines, largely in the Guardian newspaper, that would come up with a new example of phone hacking. And James was dragged before Parliament with his father to testify about this. He was largely seen as somebody who was implicated in it, although saved in the end by, you know, we still don't know exactly what that situation, how far it went up. But he was cleared, and Rebecca Brooks, who was the other top executive who was running the British newspapers, was also cleared. And so what Rupert Murdoch did that was masterful about that scandal was sort of sacrificed his lower level employees to save his son and himself and his favorite executive.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to continue the conversation and also look at the piece you just wrote in Vanity Fair, The Civil War That Could Doom the NRA. And we'll post it online at democracynow.org. Sarah Ellison is Vanity Fair contributing editor. We'll link to her piece, Inside the Fox News Bunker, also author of War at the Wall Street Journal, Inside the Struggle to Control an American Business Empire. She also worked at the Wall Street Journal. That does it for our broadcast. Check our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
The time is 5 o'clock, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is the KBOO Evening News.
Good people, it is official. Guess Who's Coming to Radio is now 3 hours. Every second and fourth Thursday from 7 to 10 p.m., we will continue to use the airwaves as a tool of positivity, awareness, and proactivity. We have a platform, and we intend to use it to encourage liberation. Many of us in the struggle for African liberation need a positive soundtrack, so music and words which feed the mind, body, and spirit are welcome here. Your support all these years have moved us to always strive to do better radio. And now you get one more hour. Again, stay tuned every second and fourth Thursday from 7 to 10 p.m. for Guess Who's Coming to Radio on KBOO, your community radio.
Come over here to the right-hand speaker.
KBOO's book and record sale is happening August 13th at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Coote Street, starting at noon. Find treasures amongst the stacks of donated items while raising money for KBOO, your very own community radio station.
Friction between the stylus and the record produces a force which makes the arm try to swing towards the record center.
Again, that's KBOO's book and record sale, Saturday, August 13th from noon to 7 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Coote Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm now standing in the center, and my voice should be located precisely midway between the speakers.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News tonight,
Rural Organizing Project organizers are harassed by Patriot Movement members at a Black Lives Matter commemoration in Josephine County.
In South Dakota, a proposed Bakken oil pipeline is being fought by local indigenous communities who say that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers have thrown out its own process in order to push the deal through.
The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration rejected requests to reclassify marijuana from its current status as a dangerous drug, though it will allow expanded production to support medical research.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 11th, 2016. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith.
Members of the Rural
organizing project have had a hard week of harassment around their progressive work in rural southern Oregon. First, the group was forced to shut down a weekly event called the Feed the Berg in Douglas County after harassment from a local shopkeeper, as well as local chapters of the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters. The Feed the Berg potluck was created by a lesbian couple in order to feed houseless people in Douglas County. It dates back to the beginning of the Occupy movement 5 years ago. After the local shopkeeper published the couple's address on Facebook and threatened to bring a gun to the meeting, they thought it safer to cancel this week's gathering. After canceling the feed, the couple was targeted for trampling on the Second Amendment rights of the shopkeeper. Then in Josephine County last night, a Black Lives Matter vigil was harassed as local members of the Oath Keepers shouted "All Lives Matter." The leader of the Josephine County Oath Keepers then took a megaphone, calling the local organizer of the event a racist and accusing him of threatening law enforcement. Tune in to KBOO's Evening News tomorrow for more on this story.
Oregon Public Broadcasting employees staged an informational picket outside the station's studios last night in order to call attention to issues around union negotiations. The Service Employees International Union, SEIU, represents dozens of workers at the NPR affiliate, and they are saying that station management is trying to break the union. The union has also planned another picket on August 23rd. Aisha Owens spoke at the informational picket last night about what's at stake for workers.
My name is Aisha, and I am the union president here at OPB's SEIU. I've been president for about 5 years here, so it's been an honor to work with such a great group of people and to have so much support, so thank you guys for coming out. I really appreciate that again. I just want to tell you that we have a lot of represented employees here at OPB and here at OPB, and I just want to let you know that why this is so important to us to be part of the union, and that they've come out to do that. And we want to tell them about what we've done in the past as far as all of these union workers. In the past, we've had contracts where OPB was having hard times, and we have sacrificed, especially on the economical side, things like some of our retirement was almost cut into 40%, and our health care, which was fully paid, has been denied to us. So those are just things that were economically changed for us as far as with contracting with OPB, but it was things that the workers were willing to sacrifice to make sure that this place was able to do the things that it needed to do. And now that they are in a good place of fundraising, they have definitely come out of that time and are in definitely a better budgetary period and doing a lot more things. We have obviously came up to a very different contract time. So we've asked them to help with the cost of the increased living here in Portland. We definitely have asked about that because of the fact that, as everybody knows, here in Portland has definitely been a higher cost of living. So, to review of the proposals that we've got sent to us, most of it has been that they want us to be in line with the other employees, and that this proposal is, they're wanting to get rid of our guaranteed pay raises, which is why we are mostly here. So our guaranteed pay raises are definitely important to us. So this is a big reason on the response to the proposals, and putting us in line with all of the other employees here lets us know that they are definitely trying to do union busting moves that has definitely brought to our attention. So we have some flyers going out, and we have obviously have people here with signs, but we are definitely asking people to show their concern, obviously to the CEO here of the company, Steve Bass, that we are just asking for just a minimal gain on what we've all have lost. We did not ask for completely all the things that we lost here, and we just really want something to be fair in return, as they are doing in a better place. So we think that that's very fair to ask of them, and that's the biggest reason that we're out here. So we hope that also too you can bring those concerns to Steve Bass.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
On Friday, the Service Employees International Union and the Oregon Education Association each gave $750,000 to a newly formed campaign committee backing Measure 97. Here's Jemani Ward-Lewis back at it again with the report.
Fundraising for the expensive battle over a corporate tax measure on the November ballot has started to pick up, with supporters last week reporting $1.5 million in donations by two public employee unions. On Friday, the Service Employees International Union and the Oregon Education Association each gave $750,000 to a newly formed campaign committee backing Measure 97. That brings the total raised by supporters to more than $2 million. According to state campaign finance records for the campaign's various political action committees. So far, the campaigns have not reported spending any of the latest contributions. Meanwhile, the campaign to defeat Measure 97 reported raising $5.5 million by the end of July, with some of the largest donations from automobile dealers, Phillips 66 Oil Company, and Cambia Health Solutions. If supporters and opponents raise amounts similar to at least one previous Oregon ballot fight, the combined total could reach $30 million. Measure 97, previously known as Initiative Petition 28, would charge certain C corporations a 2.5% tax on gross annual sales in Oregon above $25 million. That rate would be higher than in any of the five other states that impose what is known as a gross receipt tax. Supporters of the measure say it would require the legislature to spend more money on early childhood and K-12 education, healthcare, and senior services. However, last week a lawyer for the legislature issued an opinion that lawmakers could spend the money as they please simply by passing routine budget bills. To hear more about Measure 97, you can head over to kboo.fm/archives, where our reporter Ray Bodwell interviewed Otto Schell, Juan Carlos Ordonez, and John Taponia on the issues. For KBOO News, I'm Jemani Ward-Lewis.
The parents of Andrea Michelle Selby, a 36-year-old woman, have filed an $8.2 million lawsuit against Kaiser Permanente on her behalf, claiming that the HMO refused to admit their suicidal daughter, even though she threatened to leap off the third story of the hospital's parking garage. She did jump, and now has extensive brain damage. The suit states that Andrea was tormented by, quote, severe and menacing delusions, and that she had been known to harm herself. While off campus, Selby set her hair on fire, then she returned to Kaiser, fell to the ground in front of Kaiser security personnel. The suit states that she then walked up to the third floor rooftop of the parking garage and jumped off. Selby has suffered a traumatic brain injury, broken pelvis and leg, a ruptured bladder, and blunt force trauma throughout her body, among other injuries. She now requires constant care and, quote, needs to be institutionalized because of her inability to care for herself, according to the suit. The suit also faults Kaiser for allegedly failing to inform Selby's parents about the status of their daughter the night that she waited in the emergency room or on the morning that she was told to leave. They allegedly failed to give her psychiatric medications that might have addressed her problem and allegedly failed to rehospitalize her after seeing that she was in dire need.
Oregon's Higher Education Commission approved a dramatic budget request Thursday that would represent more than 40% increases in operating support for public universities and community colleges. The Higher Education Coordinating Commission unanimously approved the 2017-2019 biennial budget request at a meeting Thursday at Columbia Gorge Community College in the Dalles. The request includes over $900 million in operating support for public universities, a 42% increase from existing spending levels. For community colleges, the budget includes $795 million for the state's 17-2 colleges, a 44% increase for the current two-year cycle. From the current two-year cycle, the budget is anything but a done deal, though, and comes as the state faces a projected revenue shortfall of more than $1 billion due to the public pension obligations, and as voters mull over a controversial business tax on the November ballot that has state agencies treading water as they wait for answers.
The average black or Hispanic family lags well behind the average white family in terms of wealth accumulation, according to a new study, which blames current economic policies for contributing to this widening wealth gap. KBOO's Lila Yao reports in partnership with the Oregon News Service.
If current trends continue, a new study says it will take the average African-American family 228 years to accumulate the amount of wealth the average white family has today. It will take the average Latino family 84 years to do the same. The Ever-Growing Gap Report by the Corporation for Economic Development and the Institution for Policy Studies, or IPS, looked at trends in household wealth for families from 1983 to 2013. Josh Hoxie with the IPS says widening racial gaps in home ownership and median incomes are part of the overall wealth gap.
The story we're seeing around wealth is that this problem has been growing for decades and is going to continue for decades unless we take serious action.
In Oregon, African Americans' median income are 36% lower than whites, according to a study from the financial research website WalletHub. The new report says the wealth gap is far worse. Median wealth for Hispanics and blacks is about 90% lower than the whites nationwide. Hoxie says home ownership is one of the biggest ways families build wealth, and minority families are far less likely to own homes after years of discriminatory house policies. He says an upside-down tax system has also contributed to the disparity by putting money in the pockets of the disproportionate number of white homeowners.
So what we have is a system to incentivize wealth creation, which is a good thing. However, the bad thing is that that system is currently benefiting people who are already wealthy and contributing to the racial wealth divide.
The report says the minimum wage is another piece of the wealth puzzle. This year, Oregon lawmakers passed a minimum wage hike for the state, separating the state into three different pay zones, with the Portland metro area seeing the largest increase at $14.75 an hour by 2022. Hoxie says a low minimum wage can hurt families who are simply trying to stay above water.
When we don't raise the minimum wage for a long time, it's not just that people aren't creating new wealth. They're not creating a safety net to fall back on hard times. They're also going further into debt just to cover their basic expenses.
For KBOO News, this is Lila Yao.
The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration rejected requests to reclassify marijuana from its current status as a dangerous drug, though it will allow expanded production to support medical research. The agency said cannabis does not meet the criteria for currently accepted medical use and treatment in the United States, that there is a lack of accepted safety for its use, and that it has a high potential for abuse. The announcement disappointed cannabis legalization advocates in Oregon and nationwide, who pressed the Obama administration to remove marijuana altogether from the federal government's schedule of controlled substances. Thursday's decision does nothing to address issues confronting marijuana businesses operating in states like Oregon and Washington, where the drug is legal. Legal marijuana producers and retailers, for example, have trouble accessing banking services because of the federal prohibition on marijuana. Oregon is among 25 states where marijuana is legal for medical and or recreational use.
TriMet here in Portland is preparing for an $11 million project to shore up MAX tracks on the Steel Bridge. Here is KBOO reporter Jamani Ward-Lewis with more information.
TriMet is preparing for an $11 million project to shore up MAX tracks on the Steel Bridge, the light rail system's primary bottleneck. The work, the bulk of which is still as much as 5 years away, would focus on replacing 30-year-old tracks installed when MAX first debuted in Portland, allowing trains to move more quickly over the bridge. The move is TriMet's latest effort to resolve reliability issues that have dogged the system. It will be doing 2 weeks of disruptive work later this month to replace tracks in the Rose Quarter. And earlier this year, it replaced a length of aging track along First Avenue in downtown Portland. Trains currently travel no faster than 10 miles per hour when crossing the bridge. After the repairs, travel speed could increase to 15 or 20 miles per hour. The Steel Bridge project would also aim to resolve signal issues that have caused service disruptions. Recurring drainage problems have tipped up sensors in the bridge, triggering signals that trains aren't cleared across. Staffers, citing the complicated nature of the work, are asking the agency's board of directors to let it forego the usual process of selecting the lowest bidding contractor, instead opting for the most qualified firm. The technical work is also why the price tag is much higher than other recent track replacement projects. The First Avenue project cost $2.1 million. The Rose Quarter track work is expected to cost $2.5 million. The Steel Bridge work is expected to cost around $11 million. MAX trains cross the bridge more than 600 times each weekday. TriMet is also studying the long-term future of the Steel Bridge. It hired engineering consultancy CH2M Hill earlier this year to assess the short-term repairs while also coming up with options for increasing the bridge's carrying capacity, including assessing a possible replacement. The firm will be paid up to $800,000. Its findings aren't complete, and the long-term work could still be 30 years away. For KBOO News, I'm Jamani Ward-Lewis.
In South Dakota, a proposed Bakken oil pipeline is being fought by local indigenous communities who say that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers have thrown out its own process to push the deal through. KBOO's Chris Andre spoke today with Billy Wilson of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe about the Dakota Access Pipeline, which was approved over their objections.
Well, I've been out there for a few months now opposing this. We've been waiting for the Corps, hopefully not to issue the permit, but here last week they did. The Dakota Access are doing these things. You know, they ain't got no environmental impact statements. They don't have no people that, you know, watch every shovel full being dug for any bones and stuff like that coming up. On the west side of the Missouri River, they're going to be going through well, a non-native owns this land now, but on that land there's burial sites and old campsites and stuff, and they're going to be going right through them with no regards to our peoples or anything like that. On the east side, we've been watching them lay pipe and stuff. They stopped to the core of the engineer lines there by the river, and they've been waiting for this big drill to show up. Drilled underneath there, but I left there Saturday morning because I thought, you know, they was filing these injunctions and lawsuits and stuff with the courts, and I thought that would have put a hold on things for 30-60 days, you know. But here Tuesday they're starting to want to work and try to get this work done before I guess the courts might put a stop to them. And so Tuesday, I think it is that our people down there started putting up barriers, roadblocks, and barriers in front of the entrance on the west side there. And I guess today, this morning, people are being arrested and stuff. And they really need help back there with bail bond money and stuff like that. So if anybody out there, you know, got extra funds, man, that can help bail our people out, you know, get a hold of Sacred Stone Camp on Facebook there on their page, and hopefully these can help out. Right now, I wanted to leave this morning to head back myself, but I only had one person help me with funds, enough for gas to get back there, but I really need more, you know, to stay there and to have funds for gas, you know, because everything's so far away, you got to travel 50 to 30 to 50 miles.
That's the Dakotas. Billy, I want to ask you about the last time we spoke, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service revoked the Sovereign Lands construction permit for the Dakota Access Pipeline. Apparently... What changed? Would you have any idea of what special interests?
I'm not sure what happened with fish and game, or they call it the game and fish. Seems like a lot of these organizations or them people like that, they just going along with Dakota Access, you know.
But treaties, this does in fact violate a treaty that had.
Yeah, they're violating agreements and treaties, you know. right offhand, I don't know exactly, you know, which article and all that stuff, but they are doing that. And again, you know, they're just not caring. They're just doing it, you know. It's like all our native peoples in our country, you know, we're getting dumped on by all their garbage and doing all these minings and drillings and stuff like that on our lands, close to our lands, you know. To me, it's always still that act towards genocide of us, you know. We always get the crap from this country. And when I was back there, I even found out that our first three numbers and our enrollment numbers means that we're prisoners of war, you know, so we still get treated.
Wait a minute. Can you say a bit more about that? Prisoners of war. And what first three numbers? Talk about that for a minute, because that's something, again, a lot of this stuff is kept under wraps, and the public does not have access through the media to this news. Tell us more about the prisoner of war
designation. Well, I was there in a consul chamber when this woman who did a lot of research and stuff come up and told the consul that she found out that the first three numbers in our enrollments means that we're prisoners of war. Probably because our people and Cheyennes and killed Custer, you know.
North Carolina judge W. Douglas Parsons has ruled today that there was insufficient evidence years ago to convict a Wilmington man for an alleged murder that happened 28 years ago. Johnny Small, who is now 42 years old, is going to be set free. He was 15 years old when he was first convicted and has spent 28 years in jail convicted of murder. Parsons' decision came after learning that Small's teenage friend had been pressured by the police to testify that both he and Small were at the murder scene. Small's friend, named David Bollinger, testified in court that a Wilmington homicide investigator made up the story regarding Small's participation in the murder, and that his grandfather pressured him to lie in court. In public comments on the case, Judge Parsons has said, "Whoever did this is a monster. What I'm here to decide is, did he receive a fair trial? It is more than abundantly clear that he did not."
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump accused President Obama of being the founder of terrorist group ISIS. On Wednesday at a speech in Sunrise, Florida, Donald Trump claimed that Obama was the founder of ISIS. He added to that by saying that Hillary Clinton was the co-founder of the terrorist group. While Trump could have made his statement valid by arguing that Obama's decision to withdraw the troops from Iraq allowed such an organization to form, he did not elaborate, instead choosing to simply repeat the phrase, "He is the founder of ISIS." Hillary Clinton responded to the accusation by saying that it was, quote, "a false claim from a presidential candidate with an aversion to truth and an unprecedented lack of experience."
So it's 6 o'clock, and at 7, it'll be Guess Who's Coming to Radio with host Jamila Bourdon. She'll explore lyrical responses to unrequited love, toxic relationships, and other forms of heartbreak and grief through music. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be hot and sunny with highs near 96. East of the Cascades and in Hood River, clear and sunny with highs around 94. Today in history, in 1965, an African-American driver in the Watts area of Los Angeles was pulled over by police, an event which ultimately triggered a series of riots that rocked the nation at the time. The quote for today is from Martin Luther King, who said, "When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered."
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
For WIN, I'm Joanne Powers. 48,000 grocery workers in Central and Southern California have narrowly averted a massive strike by overwhelmingly approving a new contract. The three-year contract with Ralph's, Vons, and Albertsons stores protects worker pensions, increases wages, and gives workers more control over their scheduling. Rick Icaza, president of United Food and Commercial Workers Local 770, says that Monday was the deadline for avoiding a strike.
It was so close that we were planning a strike on Monday, only to discover that we were able to bring about a victory for the members with a good contract.
The union negotiated an increase in worker pay on top of the implementation of California's minimum wage increase.
We were able to implement probably the most expensive cost to the employers of all times. And then on top of that, we were able to eliminate some of the bad employer proposals, which would have taken away proper funding of our pension. And on top of that, medical benefits will proceed.
Local 770 workers struck for 142 days in 2003. And while a strike was averted this week, Icaza says the workers' victory stems from their willingness to strike.
Without having to literally go on strike, we were able to preserve all these things. I guess the threat was more important. A strike would have been devastating for the industry. I don't think anybody would have won. We came out with a victory, and the members were thrilled that they didn't have to go on strike, although they would have if they had to.
30,000 mechanics and ground workers at American Airlines reached a deal this week for immediate raises, up to 55% for some workers. The increase was approved separately from a contract that is still in negotiation between the airline and an association of the Transport Workers Union and the International Association of Machinists. Sean Doyle is International Vice President for the TWU.
We consider this a victory for every association member at American Airlines. This interim agreement provides significant raises to our members who have sacrificed so much through the years. They richly deserve this increase, and we will continue to fight for a strong contract that restores the dignity on the job and respect on the job.
Airline wages have been stagnating for years, and American Airlines workers have given huge concessions over the last decade and a half.
Since 9/11, we have been through quite a bit here in the airline industry as a whole. In 2003, we gave voluntary concessions to keep American Airlines out of bankruptcy. American Airlines ended up in bankruptcy. We took significant concessions again. It's been quite an ordeal for the employees for the last 15 years. Now, with the company making record profits, it's time for American Airlines to step up and recognize the employees' sacrifices across the board.
Brought to you by Union Active, your certified iOS and Android mobile app developer, offering high-quality, union-made mobile apps backed by a support team which upgrades your product to every new mobile operating system. Features, pricing, and examples are online at unionactive.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Khadija Sultana, one of the three British schoolgirls who joined ISIS in February of 2015, is believed to have been killed in May during an airstrike in Syria. All three of the girls had married members of ISIS, with two of them becoming widows within the year. Sultana's husband, an American with Somali roots, is believed to have died last year in December. Sultana had become disillusioned with ISIS and had been hoping to plan a return home before she was killed. Her sister stated that, "We were expecting this in a way, but at least we know she's in a better place." The whereabouts of the other two girls, Amira Abase and Shamima Begum, are still not certain.
The World Social Forum has been held regularly around the world since 2001, bringing together tens of thousands of activists committed to social justice and resistance to vulture capitalism. Originally conceived as an alternative to the annual World Economic Forum, this year it's in Canada with about 15,000 attendees registered from a myriad of movements from anti-militarism to environmental causes and resistance to rising income inequality. Greg McDougall is there.
The World Social Forum's motto is, "Another world is needed. Together, it is possible." Since 2001, it's been held in cities like Mumbai, Nairobi, and Tunis. But this year, organizers tried something different by making Montreal the host city. Canada is the first country in the global north to host the forum. Montreal specifically was chosen in large part due to the Quebec student movement, with the Maple Spring months-long student-led protests of 2012. Rita Friere, a Brazilian member of the International Council of the Forum, explains.
People from the north,
talents that is not too different for some communities, some populations, that we should to try to exchange experience to make another world more democratic, more with more justice possible for everyone.
Organizers have run into problems here. Less than a week before the forum opened, it came to light that the Canadian government had denied visas for at least 200 participants, including lawmakers from 5 countries. Most impacted were from African and Latin American nations. The future direction and structure of the forum are a major focus of deliberation here, as many realize changes need to be made for the forum to be more effective in catalyzing change. But there's still optimism in the halls as ideas are exchanged in real time. Anya Kovacs of the Internet Democracy Project in India sees one role of the forum as addressing the challenge of shifting the global mood back towards more of a language of solidarity, justice, and humanity.
People who have organized over long periods of time, struggling to build connections in a world where increasingly global capital is back on the rise, and culturally, as people here have been pointing out, there is also more and more across the world a move to the right. That means there is a set of values that is dominant that's not really hospitable to the activists that are here and the work that they do.
The gathering wraps up on Sunday, August 14th. Craig McDougall, FSRN, Montreal.
Newly released documents have shed light on the United States government's dealings with the former military dictatorship in Argentina. KABU reporter Sam Bowman has more.
Several documents were released by the U.S. government today relating to U.S. involvement in the Argentine Dirty War. The so-called war coincides with the military regime that ruled Argentina from 1976 to 1983. The regime tried to consolidate its power and project legitimacy by harshly cracking down on genuine radical militants, but the brutality extended to citizens guilty of little more than left-wing political views. As many as 30,000 people were disappeared, presumed tortured and executed during those 6 years. The disappearances and years of dictatorship have left a permanent mark on Argentine culture and politics. The newly released documents, obtained via a Freedom of Information Act request by the National Security Archive, show the U.S. foreign policy establishment far from united in its treatment of the Argentine regime and its blatant human rights violations. It makes for sometimes queasy reading, including a summary of a visit to the country by former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. Kissinger was in the country during the 1978 World Cup in his role as chairman of the North American Soccer League, but that didn't stop him from giving an off-the-cuff talk at the Argentine Council on International Relations, in which he praised the regime for its actions to fight terrorism. He did stress that methods used to fight terrorists, in this case the very real Montoneros urban guerrilla group, must not continue to be used when the terrorists have been vanquished. National Security Council official Robert Pastor writes in a follow-up memo that Kissinger's comments were, quote, the music the Argentine government was longing to hear. It is generally accepted that the Montoneros were completely obliterated in the first couple years of the regime, though disappearances and anti-left crackdowns continued until 1983. The rest of the released documents show members of National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski's staff grappling with how the U.S. should react to the continued violation of human rights by the Argentine regime. The documents show that the U.S. was fully aware of the nature of the regime's tactics of disappearance, torture, and murder, and the fact that the continued use of those tactics had more to do with army politics than actual security. There is frequently expressed worry that U.S. policy towards Argentina is undermining the Carter administration's proud stance on human rights in the Western Hemisphere. Remember, this is mostly before the wave of grim conflicts in El Salvador, Nicaragua, and other places that marked the 1980s. However, one of the documents goes as far as presenting a sober assessment of the effectiveness of Argentina's counterterrorism strategy, and points to the failure of more liberal policies in countries like the U.S., West Germany, and Italy, where groups like the Red Brigades were hell-bent on destabilizing the government. In explaining why the Argentine government continued using brutal tactics after the Montoneros were neutralized, the document concludes bluntly, quote, the Argentines have recourse to disappearance because it worked. For KABU Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
According to a weekly report by the Palestine Center for Human Rights, violations have allegedly persisted at the hands of Israeli forces during a reporting period from August 4th to August 10th. Peaceful Palestinian protests held by civilians have been met with excessive force, overwhelmingly against younger members of the Palestinian community. During this period, 13 Palestinian civilians were wounded, 7 on the West Bank and 6 in the Gaza Strip. On August 10th, 2 Palestinian children and 3 adults were wounded by Israeli fire when the Al-Amari refugee camp in Al-Biray was raided in search of weapons.
Human rights groups are reacting with alarm to a proposed $1.15 billion transfer of United States battle tanks and other weapons and equipment to Saudi Arabia, just a day after the Gulf country resumed bombing Yemen's capital city. FSRN's Jacob Resnick has more.
The Saudi-led military coalition resumed airstrikes on the Yemeni capital Sana'a this week, targeting Iran-backed Houthi rebels, but hitting civilian targets as well. On Tuesday, warplanes leveled a snack food plant in a country already beset by chronic food shortages. Plant spokesman Mustafa Amra told Chinese broadcaster CCTV that he couldn't understand why his factory was targeted.
It's a factory producing children's foods and cookies. The airstrikes killed 15 male and female workers and injured 8 others. Other employees now have no jobs, no source of income. There was no ammunition or weapons in the plant, nothing. It's just a civilian factory run by Yemeni businessmen.
The Saudi-led airstrikes resumed the same day the U.S. State Department announced it was greenlighting a $1.15 billion arms transfer to Riyadh. Included in the package is at least 130 M1A1A2 Abrams battle tanks and more than 400 heavy machine guns. The Saudi-led military coalition has killed more than 6,000 people in Yemen, many of them children, mostly through airstrikes, but also in ground operations as it seeks to prop up Yemen's government in exile. The renewed airstrikes led reporters in Washington to quiz State Department spokeswoman Elizabeth Trudeau about the cause and effect of transferring more heavy weaponry to the Saudis.
Is the State Department concerned that U.S. weapons that have been sent to Saudi Arabia will take part in the killing of civilians?
So what I would say is we regularly talk to our partners and our allies around the world. You know, civilian casualties are obviously of grave concern to us.
Congress has 30 days from Monday to block the deal. Already, Senators Chris Murphy of Connecticut and Rand Paul of Kentucky, a Democrat and Republican respectively, have vowed to oppose the transfer. But the political clout of General Dynamics, the deal's main benefactor, makes Capitol Hill approval almost certain. And rights groups are concerned.
The U.S. shouldn't be selling any weapons to Saudi Arabia until Saudi Arabia curbs its unlawful attacks and investigates the unlawful attacks that have sort of already taken place in Yemen up until today.
That's Christina Beckerel, an Amman, Jordan-based researcher with Human Rights Watch. She says the United States' role in the Saudi-led campaign in Yemen is much bigger than many realize.
The U.S. not only sort of is providing intelligence support to the Saudi-led coalition, it's also providing refueling of their jets. So because of all of this and because of things that are within the public record, we do know that the U.S., in fact, is itself a party to the conflict in Yemen, which means that it itself has an obligation to investigate any unlawful strikes in which it may have been involved. And there's not been nearly enough transparency to the U.S. people or writ large about what the U.S. is in fact doing in Yemen, and what the U.S. is in fact doing in Yemen to ensure that protection of civilians is sort of paramount and ensured during ongoing fighting.
If approved, this latest weapons transfer to the Saudis would be the second deal valued more than $1 billion since November. And it's part of a larger pattern of massive U.S. arms exports around the world. The Defense Security Cooperation Agency reports that weapons deals facilitated by the Pentagon topped $47 billion during the past fiscal year, making the U.S. far and away the largest arms dealer in the world. Jacob Resnick, FSRN.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Layla Yao, Grace Ann Smith, Kelsong Nima, and Jemani Ward-Lewis. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to Jamie Partridge and Becky Myers. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Coming up tomorrow morning, Friday, on KBOO at 7, it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, Ani and Lynn will discuss the Rock Against the TPP, which is a tour organized by Fight for the Future and Firebrand Records, also a diverse coalition of groups fighting against the corporate power grab that is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. At 9, we'll hear the pilot program of The Beloved Community, as John Shuck speaks with Marianne Williamson, who is an author, lecturer, and activist, also C. Scott Brown, who is an activist and author, and Jenna Yokoyama, co-host of the KBOO program Pacific Underground. At 10, it'll be Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints, Investigative News Radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 a.m. tomorrow, The Digital Divide is off this month. Instead, we'll hear Facing Climate Change, a documentary about climate change and its effects specifically in the Skagit Valley. Thanks to all of you KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
On August 9th, Clackamas County Jail Commander Captain Lee Eby spoke in Milwaukee to the Clackamas NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Health. He spoke about the new transition center for people released from the Clackamas Jail and programs and services for people with